Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello, we're continuing our study in Numbers. Today we're going to be kind of in a catch-all literary unit, I guess. It deals with chapters 27 through 30 that form a literary unit, but it's a literary unit of miscellaneous items, if you please. But it's some items, I think, that we all wonder why they're in the particular order they're in. I must admit to you that much of the Pentateuch is out of order in the sense of a logical presentation of the truth. Sometimes the things are divided up. We're going to find that here. For what reason, we're not sure. I think in the Jewish mind that there is a order here. I just think it's hard for those of us in the Western cultures to understand it. I don't assume, as many do, that means there are many different literary pieces here. I reject personally the J.E.D.P. theory of source criticism for the Pentateuch and hold to a basically mosaic authorship with the possibility of editors either by Joshua or Eliezer and probably maybe later on by Jeremiah and Ezra. Let's begin at chapter 27 then. The first few verses, verses 1 through 11, deal with a very unique problem where a man dies in the wilderness wandering period and has no sons. And we're going to see something of how laws developed within Israel as these daughters approach the powers that be to ask about that. Now, notice it says, now the daughters of Zelophehad, I'm not sure how you pronounce that either, came to him and they mentioned that their father had died in the wilderness. Now, this same man is mentioned several times. You might want to see chapters 26, 33. You might want to see Numbers 36, where an appendix to this account is edited. And then Joshua 17, 3. Now, notice it says that these were three daughters, and they stood before three groups, Moses and Eleazar. That'll be Moses as the official representative, Eleazar as the new high priest. Before the elders, there's that representative, we think, elective, smaller group of members of the tribe. And the whole congregation. We have these same kind of three polity forms, I think, developing in the New Testament between the apostles, the elders, and the congregation. That's probably why in several denominations there are different polity types, from Episcopal to Presbyterian to congregational, is that all of these have some precedent in the Scriptures. Now, at the door of the tent of meeting would be at the tabernacle. And they say, our fathers died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those who gathered themselves against the Lord in company with Korah. But he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. And that's very interesting. Why would they say he died in his own sin? They recognize it was a punishment of God for listening to the spies' report. And so it's a way the daughters are saying, we don't think that God's justice is impugned in our father's death with no sons. We think he died, though, not as a result of a direct rebellion. Now, I think this is interesting for several things. Number one, it does show that these daughters believe in the fairness of Yahweh. And not only that, this is before they enter the promised land, and they're talking about inheritance rights. They believe the promises of God. That's what John Calvin comments on this, and I think it's very true. No land had been captured yet, but they were already thinking about it because they already knew that God was going to fulfill his promise to the patriarchs and give the people the promised land. Now, this idea about not among Korah, some believe that those who died for specific religious rebellions, property was confiscated along with their own death and exclusion from the community of Israel. So what they may be saying is our father's property was not confiscated. He was one that should inherit land. Now, notice this that says, and Moses brought their case before the Lord. That's very interesting, I think, because what it shows is Moses just isn't giving us his opinion about this or that. He's going to the Lord. The implication here, God is going to answer this specific request. It also shows how laws probably developed in Israel. There was a general law given at Mount Sinai, but later on there became special cases. And I think you show something of the leniency and fairness and involvement of deity in the daily lives of the Hebrew community as you see this case unfolding. And Yahweh answers in the affirmative. Now in Numbers 36, this is going to be developed again as the problem of what if these girls marry, and then what happens to the inheritance rights? And all of that's dealt with because this does not give us all the information we need for this particular account. But it is very interesting, I think. It shows the equality of women. These daughters will inherit. It shows that although there is a patriarchal system, that women did have rights, that they were thought of, that they were taken into account, and on and on. And I think it's very interesting. Now, beginning in verse 12 through 23, we have something for the preparation of Moses' death. Many wonder why it should happen now. Well, if you try to play psychologist, and I think many commentators do, which we have no basis, you would think as God gave a positive answer to a special request of these daughters, maybe Moses is still trying and still asking God about, now God, what about my unique problem? Remember you said I couldn't enter the promised land? God, have you rethought that? Is there any possibility? And God's going to say, no, Moses. I'm no respecter of persons. Aaron's already dead because of it on Mount Hor. Moses, you're going to die and not enter the promised land because you publicly disobeyed me. Let's look at it. And the Lord said to Moses, go up to this mountain of Abiram. Now, that's interesting because Abiram, back in, let's see where it is. It's earlier than this. I believe it's chapter 16, 1, is one of the sons of Reuben that rebelled with Korah. Now, some say it just happened to be the same name. Well, the reason I think maybe it's more than that, this is going to be in the tribal allocation of Reuben, and this was one of the sons of Reuben. Did they name the mountain after this boy later? We're just not sure. Was it already named this, and maybe the meaning of the name had something to do with it? We're just not certain. Now, we know this mountain goes by several names. It seems there's a ridge of mountain named the Abiram, and some say this whole ridge is also called Pisgah, P-I-S-G-A-H, Pisgah. And the highest peak is called Nebo. Same kind of thing with Horeb and Sinai. Are they the same? Well, Sinai seems to be a non-Hebrew name for the region, the wilderness of Sin, and Horeb seems to be a Hebrew name. Here we have three different names for this mountain: Nebo, Pisgah, and the mountain range of Abiram. Now, notice it says, and see the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. Of course, it'll be the tribe of Reuben. And when you have seen it, you too shall be gathered to your people. You might want to see Deuteronomy 34, 1 through 8, where it is account of Moses' death. Now, I wonder here when it says gathered to your people. We've talked about it before. It seems like from Deuteronomy 34 that God is going to bury Moses. Nobody knew where he was because I think God knew that people would turn Moses' grave into a shrine as the Jews have to King David's grave in Jerusalem. And he took all those kinds of things away from us, I think. Now, the rabbis say that God kissed Moses on the mouth and took away his breath. That's a beautiful thing. But I think, again, gathered to your fathers must have an implication for the Hebrews of a fellowship in family and community beyond the grave. Notice it says, from the wilderness of Zin. It'd be very good for you to be able to look at a map of Sinai and see if you can find the wilderness of Shur, where they came out of the land of Goshen, the wilderness of Sin, S-I-N, where Mount Sinai is, down, we believe, in the southern part of the peninsula, though we're not sure. The wilderness of Paran, which is where they're going to go from Sinai to get to Kadesh Barnea, it's on the eastern side of the Sinai Peninsula. And then the wilderness of Zin, Z-I-N, is kind of just below Beersheba, down in the area of Kadesh Barnea. And that's where we think they're talking about. You rebelled against my command to treat me as holy before the eyes, for their eyes at the water. Now, these are the waters of Meribah, which means bitterness, of Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. Now, we're not sure exactly what happened there. Moses was to speak to the rock. Moses struck the rock. Some say he messed up the messianic significance of the rock being struck only once, being Christ. Others say that the people heard Yahweh say to Moses, speak to the rock, but in Moses' anger at the people's rebellion, he struck it. And that public disobedience is the problem. Whatever, it was a serious thing, and God is no respecter of persons. And Moses prays in verse 16, O Yahweh, the Elohim of the Ruah of all flesh. Now, I think that's interesting. Ruah is the word for breath or life. Go back to Genesis 2:7. I think here it's saying that the word Yahweh itself is from the Hebrew verb to be. I think it's saying, thou only source of life. Everything that has life, plants, animals, human beings, gets that life from God. God, the spirits of all flesh. Appoint a man over the congregation. Now, I'm not sure exactly how this request is related to Deuteronomy 18:15, where the title, the prophet, comes, where it says, one after me, a prophet, one of your own people, listen to him, which comes a title for the Messiah in the New Testament that we see in John when they ask him, are you Elijah? Are you the prophet? Are you Jeremiah? It became a messianic prophet. How that asking for a successor is related to this, it's uncertain. Moses knew he was going to die, and apparently he asked for someone to take his place. And, of course, the obvious choice is Joshua, his lieutenant, who has been a godly man, one of the two spies who gave a good report, been with Moses throughout this time, the military leader of Israel, up on Mount Sinai, at least partway with Moses when the Ten Commandments were given. Notice the metaphor here, go in and out, lead them. There's been some debate among Hebrew scholars whether this means daily life or military campaigns, and I'm not sure we can make a distinction there. But notice it says, like sheep who have no shepherd. This pastoral metaphor of the leaders of Israel as sheep or shepherds, God as the ultimate shepherd, runs throughout the Old Testament and becomes symbolized in a messianic title in John chapter 10. Notice then in verse 18, so the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hands on him. Notice that the Spirit is already in him and does not come at the laying on of hands. Notice this thing about the man and whose spirit. You may want to see chapter 11, verse 25, for another account of the Spirit being on someone, which shows that we shouldn't make too high of a dichotomy between the Spirit being on people in the Old Testament, in people in the New. I don't think we can make that distinction. The Holy Spirit has been active. He was active in Joshua's life, even before the laying on of hands. The laying on of hands in the Bible is very interesting. It's done sometime for these sacrifices to identify the animal with the man. I think that's what it's doing here. It's identifying Joshua with the leadership of Moses. Later on, the elders will lay hands on people to commission leaders. Later on, Jesus will lay hands on people to heal people. The early church laid hands on Saul and Barnabas to show they were their representatives on the mission field. And so I think there's been a development of this laying on of hands for the Bible. It's a very interesting discussion. Notice there's going to be some difference between the authority of Joshua and Moses. Joshua is not going to take Moses' place. There will be no one like Moses. You shall put some of your authority on him. And I think that's interesting. That laying on the hands, kind of an official transfer of that, is what they say. The rabbis say here that Joshua's face glowed, but did not glow as brightly as Moses did when he came from talking with God on the mountain. I don't think that could be read in the text here. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest. Notice that Moses stood directly to God, but now Joshua will have to go through Eleazar to know God's will. I believe God does address Joshua from time to time, but mostly through an angel and mostly through the high priest. Eleazar, of course, is the son of Aaron, and he has the judgment of the Urim. And, of course, this is the Urim and the Thummim that we see back in Exodus 28:30 and Leviticus 8:8. That was some means of knowing the will of God through mechanical means, a black rock, a white rock, a spelling out things. This mechanism of the Urim and the Thummim used to be the lights and the perfections was translated, but I think that's a poor translation in light of modern etymological studies. Was in behind the breastplate of the high priest in a little pouch. It was used several times in the Old Testament as a concordance will show you very readily. Now, it moves then from verse 3:3, he commissions him, but of course Joshua won't take over till much later. Now, in chapter 28, it's going to be discuss some of these sacrifices, and then in chapter 29, it's going to discuss the feast of the seventh month. That was a very important month. Several of the feast days hit right there. Now let's look, if we could, at some of the ideas of sacrifice presented in chapter 28. Many of these have been presented before in Leviticus chapters 1 through 7. Why they're repeated here, I'm simply not sure. Maybe as they talk about Eleazar, the new priest, it comes to mind. I'm simply not sure. There is some obvious repetition in the Pentateuch, and there are many theories about it. The first thing that is new we're going to talk about is the continual. And that is a lamb that'll be two lambs, one in the morning, one in the evening, that'll be killed every day, called the continual. Later on in Judaism, it was 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. You might want to see something about that in Exodus 29, 38 through 42. We're going to move here from lambs killed every day, lambs killed weekly, lambs killed at certain feast days. When you add all these lambs up and all these animals, it is unbelievable the amount of animals that were killed and the amount of flour and wine and oil that was put on the altar. Some have tried to add it up this way. There was 113 bulls, there's 32 rams, 30 goats, around 1,080 sheep. There is 170 gallons of oil and 340 gallons of wine offered on the altar annually. Woo! Shows something of the extravagance of the people in their worship that I wish we could catch in our day. Then it mentioned it in verse 4, at twilight. Now this means between the evenings. There's been some confusion here. Some say it's when the heat of the day is gone, middle of the afternoon. That's because offer that lamb at 3 o'clock. Some day it says when the sun starts to going down to when it's totally down. And others say after the sun is down before dark. We're just not sure, but the Jews interpret it around 3 o'clock. Notice it mentions all these different kinds of ephah and hin, these different measurements. If you want a great book on that, you ought to get Roland DeVoe's Israel. There's two volumes, one the secular institutions and one the religious. This will be in the secular, the different weights and measures. Roland DeVoe, Israel. I think you'll really enjoy that. Two volumes, paperback. Now, notice it says a fourth of a hen for each lamb. That's quite a bit. And notice in verse 7 it says strong drink. Now, this is usually a separate word from wine. Some say the reason it's strong drink. This is fermented. No question. This is highly fermented. Very intoxicating. Some say they couldn't get wine in the wilderness, and that's why they went to strong drink. It also shows that fermentation is not a sign of evil, because this will be poured out on the altar and then for the priest to drink. This shows that we've made too strong a statement about wine in the Bible, because here wine is provided for the priest, and a little bit was placed on the altar, shows that God did not consider wine to be evil or sin. Need to rethink through that, particularly in light of Psalms 104, verses 14 and 15, I believe, where it's considered to be a gift of God. Now, notice on the Sabbath here in verse 9, they're going to double the amount of lambs that are killed. In verse 11, we have the beginning of each month that's called the new moons. You might want to see the discussion of that in Numbers 10, verse 10, where that is talked about. There's going to be a series of sacrifices we see here, a burnt offering, a sin offering, grain offering. If you go back to Leviticus 1 through 7, it seems that there are three voluntary offerings. That would be the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the peace offering. There are two mandatory offerings, the sin offering and the guilt offering. They're related in a sense. Both are for sin, but the sin offering is that which restitution cannot be made, and the guilt offering is that which restitution can be made. These offerings seem to be given in a series that seem to say something of our dedication to God, the removal of sin, and our fellowship with God. And so it's usually a series here. Now in verse 16, we mentioned Passover. And of course, Passover is discussed in Exodus chapter 12, and the Feast of Unleavened Bread also. Here, they're put together as Passover one day and the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days, and you might want to see the discussion in Leviticus 23, verses 4 through 8. Now, in verse 26, another feast, the Day of First Fruits, also called the Feast of Weeks. You might want to see Leviticus 23, 15 through 21. But there's a little difference between Leviticus and here. In Leviticus, they have a wave offering. Here, they don't mention it. Josephus says they're two independent accounts. But I'm nervous about that because this is both reported to be by God to Moses, and that I just don't like the source critical view of the Old Testament. Now, we often call this Pentecost because it comes 50 days after Passover. Penta, of course, in Greek means 50, and that's where we get the word Pentecost. Now, in chapter 29, we have the seventh month. There were several feasts in the seventh month. It was a very important month. It'd be somewhere around, I believe, our September, October is close. The seventh month, on the first day of the month, they're to have a holy convocation called the blowing of trumpets. This is the zophar. It's the left ram's horn of the fat-tailed sheep. It's about 18 inches long, and it is discussed in Leviticus 23, verses 23 through 25. Later on in Jewish history, this will be called Rosh Hashanah, which becomes their new year service, but not yet. And also in verse 7 of chapter 29 is the 10th day of the 7th month, which we know as the Day of Atonement, which is discussed in Leviticus 16. And you might want to see that. It's also discussed in Leviticus 23, verses 26 through 32, the only fast day we know of in Israel's history, though some would say that the Passover was a fast day until the feast that night. In verse 12, we have the 15th day of the 7th month will become the Feast of Booths. It's going to be a 7th day feast, and explain through here the different kinds of sacrifices that were made on every day, a little bit different every day. You might want to see Leviticus 23, verses 33 through 36, and verses 39 through 44. Notice in verse 39, we kind of have these two sacrifices or offerings summarized. Again, the voluntary in Leviticus 1 through 7, which would be the burnt, and then, the burnt and the grain, which was a non-bloody sacrifice, a vegetable sacrifice. And then we have the peace. And, of course, the peace was broken into several different kinds, a free will vow and a fellowship and a thanksgiving offering and all that. And then we have the mandatory, which is the sin and the guilt. You might, again, want to check. Now, in chapter 30, we have a discussion of the laws of vows. We've talked about that extensively in Leviticus 27. And it was out of order, it seemed like, then. It seems to be out of order somewhat here. The Jews took vows very seriously, as you can see from Deuteronomy 23, verses 21 through 23. That should be read before you do this. Leviticus 27 should be read before you do Numbers chapter 30. It's obvious that vows were important. They've been mentioned several times in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 7, verse 16. Leviticus, 22, verses 18 through 23. And Leviticus 23, verse 38. But all about the vows were not given at that point, so this is a discussion. This is particularly about a discussion of a vow made by a lady. Now, it's going to say here, if a man makes a vow, it's binding. Nowhere in the Bible does it say you need to make a vow. But if you make one, you best keep it. God will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. To say you're going to promise something to do God and then not do it is serious. It's kind of like foxhole religion. We get in trouble, we promise God something, and then how easily we forget. God said, you don't have to promise me, but if you do, you fulfill it. Now, the reason this is given here is to kind of, what about a lady who gives a vow? You say, we're showing a patriarchal culture where ladies were just property. No. I don't think that's the background at all. If a woman made a vow to give something to God or to do something, she was under the authority of either her father or her fiancé or her husband or her brother or somebody. What if she promised something of property that did not belong to her? What if she promised something that she did not have time or means to fulfill? That's why the authority structure had to either confirm it to say, yes, that's right, we'll give that out of our property. Now, so first it mentions a man here. Then it mentions a woman who has two criteria in verse 3. She is in her father's house, i.e. unmarried or divorced or whatever, and in her youth. She's a young person. Now, we're going to see another deal in verse 16, but here's two qualifications. Now, when the father hears about her vow, he can either affirm it or deny it. If he denies it when he hears about it, then the vow is not going to hold. Now, there are several other categories here. Notice in verses 6 through 8 is about a woman who apparently is betrothed to somebody, and she makes a vow. Remember, betrothal was as binding as marriage in this culture. Makes a vow, and her husband-to-be hears about it, he can annul it. But what about verses 9 through 12 is about a widow or a divorced woman? Now, if she makes a vow, she's on her own. If she promises some of her property or some of her time or whatever, both of these, a widow or divorced person, would not be under the authority of a man, would be independent, would have their own resources at their disposal, and they would be able to do what they wanted to with it. Now, in verse 13, we have about a man and a woman who are married, not betrothed, as up here in 6 through 8, but married. And again, the husband had to confirm it. If a vow was made, it is to be fulfilled. And back in chapter 27 Leviticus, we saw that there was penalties that were had to be added if you didn't keep your vow. If you promised something you really couldn't give, you had to add a fifth part to it. Some vows you made, you couldn't get out of. You tried to get out of, you were killed. Others, if you made, you tried to substitute something, that both of them became holy. So I think we see the significance. Now look at verse 16. But if, in verse 15, if he indeed annuls them after he has heard of them, then he shall bear his guilt. When the husband immediately heard the vow, if he said, no, that's not true, the vow was broken. But if he waited a while to kind of see how things went, and then later tried to say, oh, no, we're not going to do that, then that husband's responsible for that vow and must fulfill it. If he doesn't, then I think the guilt, and there is guilt, look at Leviticus 27, he will have to bear. And then in verse 16, these are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses as between a man and his wife, as between a father and his daughter, while she is in her youth in her father's house. And that kind of closes out this literary unit. Now the question has always been, why are these laws brought in here? And I must say again, we try sometimes to force the Bible into our Western mode of outlining, into our Western mode of how we do history. The Bible has as much validity in the way it does history, in the way it records things, as our method. It's just that we're not used to them. We are sure there are some rules here and some cultural precedents. We just don't know what they are. There was a reason for Moses to do it this way, exactly why we're not sure. It seems to me, as we look at Numbers, about to go into Deuteronomy, they're about to transfer leadership. Already the priesthood's been transferred. We're talking about transferring the authority of Moses. I think he's doing at the end of Numbers in a brief sense of what he's going to do in the whole book of Deuteronomy, and that is to show how the law is applicable to a new setting. He's kind of trying to tie up a few loose ends, get them ready to pass on the whole thing to Joshua. And I think that's something of the order of this. I know these things seem rather tedious to you, but I think there are principles here that are very important. A book that I think will help you tremendously as you look through the Old Testament and say, now how does this apply to my life? And you've got to do that, because understanding the Bible involves understanding what the author was saying to his day and then applying that truth to our day. One of the best books, I think, for teaching and preaching and understand the Old Testament and then applying the truth to our day is The Authority of the Old Testament by John Bright. I hope you'll get that little book. It's sitting right over there on my shelf. I can't reach it, but I look at it often, and it's very helpful to me. It talks about principalizing these truths. An example would be in chapter 27. As these women come to Moses and ask for inheritance rights, that really tells us several things about these women. Number one, they had great faith in the promises of God. Maybe that's why this story is told here. The other Israelites are grumbling and complaining and griping and not believing God's going to give them the land. And here's a group of women, which were, as you know, were somewhat put down in their culture, saying, we want our part of the promised land because we know God's going to bring us in. It also is very important because it shows the character of God. He doesn't make a hard and fast rule and then say, no exceptions. No. God said, let's talk about that. Let's work with that. This whole book is not just Moses' opinion, but God revealing himself. God gave the general principles, and when an exception came up, he dealt with it. He deals with it in fairness, and he deals with it in grace. Tells you something about the nature of God. It also tells about the nature of Moses. He was a humble man. Didn't try to take authority and say, well, I'll give you my opinion. It's kind of like when Paul says, now the Lord hadn't spoke on this, but I'll give you my opinion. It's the same thing Moses does. He tries to get official authority. It says something about the inspiration of the whole Bible. So here in the first few verses of chapter 27 are some tremendous truths and insights into who is God, how are we to respond to Him, how did God give us the Bible, and on and on. Think through these sections. Though they may at first seem to have nothing for you, I think you'll find they have a whole lot for you. It's why they're recorded in our book. But they are a different culture. They must be understood in their day and in the universal principle applied to our day, not proof-texted. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.